When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America and shoveling driveways on Newstalk WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. On Twitter, I just tweeted out why a really snowy winter in Chicago made me buy a new car, and I definitely want to talk to you about that because I think it really relates to the economy, it relates to winter, it's snowy, all kinds of stuff. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. So I promised my boss, Pete Spriggs, I would start out with the story of the person that I knew was in her car the longest this week in the Atlanta, the Great Atlanta snowstorm. And it was somebody I work with named Michelle, and she told my team that she was in her car for 14 hours, going from Sandy Springs, I think, down to Midtown to pick up her daughter at school. 14 hours. Okay. We've all done that drive without traffic, and it's 15, 20 minutes, maybe. If you catch the lights, maybe a little less, maybe a little more. And then, you know, if you do it in rush hour, it could be an hour or more, right? And if you do it in rush hour on a Friday afternoon when it's raining, it could be 2 hours. 14 hours for that drive, I just, my only thought was, oh my goodness, it's so great that you didn't run out of gas. That was all I could think of as you were trying to stay warm. Wow, what a snowstorm, what a week, and total insanity. But it's going to be in the 50s all week, and that's great. I see that the weather forecast, maybe for a week or so from now, you might get down your lows into the 20s. So just to make you feel good again about why you live in Atlanta and not in Chicago, we're having a winter in Chicago like the winter of my childhood, literally. So we already have in Chicago 52 inches of snow. This is more like what Rochester, New York has. You know, anybody on the east side of the lakes. Okay, 52 inches of snow. It's already our fifth snowiest. It's February 2nd. We get a lot of snow usually in February and March as it warms up. January, we had 33.7 inches of snow, which is more than most winters. Most winters in Chicago average 30 to 36 inches total. People are so sick of snow here that they've stopped shoveling everything. Driveways, streets. I haven't seen the salt truck in ages. I mean, it's just now expected that you are going to drive on the street and you're going to be just fine about it. We saw a horrific crash the other day. Somebody just took a curve a little too quickly, crossed a median, went into the side, and nobody even stopped. I mean, cops came and people stopped or whatever. Nobody got hurt, but it was like, oh, you know, another crash. Look, it's winter. Just slow down, right? The snow, cold. We've had like 17 days below zero. I've stopped feeling it. Seriously. Sam and I looked at each other the other day. We went, oh, another day of -9, and it's going to be like -9 this week. Like, really? So it's our 10th coldest. Now, the snowiest winter on record is the winter of my sophomore to junior year, when it was 1978 to 79. And this, coincidentally, was Sam's snowiest winter out when he was at school out east, 89.7 inches. And I remember that year. It was also the year that, at least I think this is the same year, this might have also been like 81, where the wind chill went down to minus 80 degrees. And a friend of mine named Jill, who was sleeping over, and she was like, you know, I'm just going to walk to the corner and take the bus home. And my dad was like, Jill, it's 80 below. I'll drive you home. No, Mr. Glink, I'll be fine. And she walked to the corner and got in a bus and went home. Because after a while, you just stop. Like, it becomes a point of pride. The other day, it was minus, I don't know, 11 or something when I woke up. The wind chill was like minus 30. So, of course, I told my whole team to work from home, which is the really real beauty of having a digital company, is that, you know, if you want to let people work from home, pretty much they can be just as effective there as they can in the office. And so I just, my office is two blocks from my house, and so I just, you know, walked to the office. And even Sam thought I was crazy. Anyway, snowy days. And, of course, we're covering all the latest weather and traffic here on Newstalk WSB. And thank you to all of you who listened to us for 8 hours or whatever straight, because you couldn't have a better team watching the weather and the news for you, which is, you know, totally, totally crazy winter. This is just a crazy winter. I looked at Sam yesterday and I said, now I remember why my parents' and grandparents' generation hightailed it off to Atlanta and Florida and California, because they were so sick of these kinds of winters. We had more of these winters back in the 60s and 70s. And, in fact, when my sisters were born, my sisters are twins, that winter, which would have been whatever winter it was, like 64, 67, whatever. Somewhere in there, there was like 5 feet of snow on the ground, and my mother was trying to push the double pram, you know, with me, a 2.5-year-old in tow, and it was just madness. So, anyway, hats off to all of you who survived it. Hats off to my colleagues at WSB for guiding everybody to surviving it. And if your car's still out there, I hope you get it back. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I want to talk a little bit about how the snow has made me buy a new car this winter for the first time in 11 years. It was time to trade in the Honda minivan. I'm going to talk about in a few minutes what I bought. But in the meantime, 404-872-0750, I want to take Steve's call. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Elise. Enjoy your show.
Thanks. Nice to have you here. What's going on this Sunday? Oh, and happy Super Bowl.
Yeah, sure thing. Okay, retired a couple years now and wish to purchase a single-family home, rental property at about $100K. And talk to a couple of people, and I get a couple of ideas. And then on the second home, which I would purchase, would be to obtain a loan and, you know, mortgage and so on. And one.
Wait a second. Let me jump in because I'm a little confused. You've retired. Now you want to get into investing in real estate? And you want to buy two properties to invest in?
Well the first property will be cash.
The $100,000 is going to be a rental, and you're going to pay cash for it?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And then you're going to buy another property?
Yes, that was the thought of a particular friend who dabbles with money, financial advising, and that kind of thing. So,
okay, so two properties. First you pay cash for, and the second you're going to get a loan. What kind of a loan are you getting?
Not certain yet. So my question to you is, what kind of return, a cash-to-cash, would be, generally speaking, would be doable or acceptable? One person said, well, if you make a return of 5.8, you're doing pretty good. Another person said, if you're not making 9.5% to 10% cash-to-cash return, then I wouldn't do it at all. So I want to know your take on that.
So I guess the first question I have for you, Steve, is why are you asking your friends what they think is right for you?
Well, they're longtime friends, and they're in the financial business, so.
And is that what they make on rental real estate, rental properties?
That's
okay.
Correct.
So that's what they're making. I have heard people take acceptable cap rates from 3% all the way to 20%.
Okay.
We have a friend who does builds new multi-use or office buildings with retail. Well, it's multi-use because it's retail on the first floor, retail or restaurant, and office above. And, you know, he likes a return, an ROI of 18%.
Okay.
But none of that is relevant to you and your own financial situation. So you're retired, and you get to decide what it is you think that you should be doing with your money. Now, the friend who told you that if you're getting a 5% return on $100,000 that would be sitting in the bank earning 0.5%, I'm in the bank with that guy, right? Because you're getting a cash-on-cash return of 5%, and there may be appreciation in the property over time.
Right.
That's the model that REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts, follow, right? You get some cash-on-cash return, and then over time, the shares of stock go up. hopefully. The guy who's getting, you know, 10% is also right, because he's looking at it from a situation of, well, there might be other places that it's less risky and less time involved, and you're going to get a, if you, you know, you're going to put the time in, 10%. If you were going to do stock market last year and you chose correctly, it would have been a 30 to 60% return. We had somebody call in a couple of weeks ago and said he got a 60% return last year in his money. I thought, you should be managing money. So you could have done nothing, but put the money into an account and earned 30%, and you're, you know, so 10%, and you have to do all the work involved with rental property. I get what he's saying as well. So really, the question is, what is the best deal that you can get? Because unlike shares of stock and mutual funds and all the rest, when you invest in real estate, you really get, it's kind of a snapshot opportunity. It's that house at that particular time in that condition with that rental profile. Or it's that strip mall with the same sort of stuff. So it's a little hard to say until you find the house what you're going to do. But you have to decide, like, the idea that one of these houses is going to be in cash and one of these houses is going to be, you know, with a mortgage, I'm not even sure that's the right solution.
Right.
Right? Why? Because you're going to need 25 to 35% to put down in the second property. Maybe it's best to just put 50% down on both and get cheap loans that you just pay off over time, right? There's different ways to kind of slice and dice this. Is it better to be able to write off the interest and do a, you know, a 15-year loan so you're paying the maximum amount of interest? Is it better, you know, and get that super low interest rate? Is it better to get a 10-year loan? Like, you've got lots more options. So I guess I'm saying to you that I think both of your friends are right, but you have to decide what your money is worth and what your time is worth. And you have to think about the mechanics and all the costs that go into investing in real estate, which is why I created the Intentional Investor How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate series, because there are a lot of legal issues, and when you think about investing, what that really means and how you're going to get it, bring it into your portfolio, and how you're going to manage that, and what the return is, and how does that fit in with everything else you're doing. All of those questions are questions that you need to answer. And it's good that you're starting with what's the return, but in a lot of times I look at it the other way. What's the opportunity? What's the house? What's the property? And what are you going to have to do to get it in shape? Are you a fix and flip guy? Are you, you know, buy a 3 or a 5 or a 6 bedroom condo apartment building and convert it down? And, you know, what is it that you want to do? Are you doing a strip mall? Are you doing commercial? All of those questions are going to factor in. And when you buy commercial, by the way, some people want an ROI of 22%. So it just really depends. My Intentional Investor Series is available at thinklinkstore.com, and you can buy it there. And, Steve, let me know what you decide to do. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Klink. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, on News Talk WSB. 26 minutes past the hour on the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our numbers, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. I've actually got a pretty good question online. My wife rarely uses her Capital One card, and she had an $18 charge a couple of months ago. Capital One wrote off the cards, $70 after fees. How do we handle it? It dinged her credit. So the first question is, what was the $18 charge? And it could have been, which is sort of interesting, more about identity theft and all this stuff going on with Target. Because what's really happening, and I just happened to sit next to you on the plane the other day coming back from out of town, I happen to be sitting next to a guy who is the global head of fraud and what they call identity management for one of the three credit reporting bureaus. Just like by chance. And I said, oh, we should chat. And so we did. And what he told me was so unbelievable about what's really going on. I want to talk to you a little bit about it. But one of the things we talked about was how smart international identity thieves and fraudsters have become when it comes to all of the credit stuff. So last week and the week before, we talked about Target and we talked about what happened and how, you know, Neiman Marcus got hit and now Michael's Craft Store got hit. And he said that he thinks that there is a whole bunch of fallout coming down the pike that has not yet been revealed. More cards at risk. He agrees that fully, it may be as much as a half of all Americans over the age of 18, half would have been hit in this recent thing. But the bigger story is what is going on with fraud and the banks, which he said is not being discussed. And we had a very long hour conversation just about this one thing, where he said that if it gets bad enough, banks will stop trusting each other. They will not trust each other. And you know what happened the last time banks didn't trust each other? Hello, 2007 and 2008. We had the biggest global recession since the Great Depression. And all of it came from banks not trusting what other banks were doing and the paper they were passing. And he says the same thing is starting to happen when it comes to fraud. Absolutely fascinating conversation that I'm going to let you in on when we come back. Plus, I'm going to answer this Twitter feed question as well. At Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Call in. Lines are open, guys. 404-872-0750. We can talk about the Super Bowl, too. I just don't know very much. On the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Every Sunday, Elyse Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB, the number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, and on the internet, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com, Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So I was talking about how, we're going to still get to the new car story, I promise, but I was talking just before the break about how I happened to sit on this airplane next to a guy who's the head, it turns out, global head of fraud and identity theft for one of the big credit reporting bureaus. And we had this really wonderful conversation for an hour and a half when we realized that we both work in the same sphere about what's going on worldwide. And it's really interesting how, I don't even know what word to use. Sophisticated is probably the thing that pops into my head. How sophisticated the fraudsters have become. So one of the things that he says that is not being discussed at all, and honestly, I haven't seen anything about this in any of the papers, is how in European fraudsters, or I'm saying European, but foreign fraudsters, right? What they're doing, what they've been able to do, is they've been able to figure out how to digitally manufacture money. Now, you might be thinking that I'm talking about Bitcoin and how you mine for Bitcoin, and if you spend, you know, X amount of your computer hours doing whatever you're doing, they get, you know, you get a Bitcoin. That's not what I'm talking about. This guy says that these fraudsters, there are fraudsters around the world who have perfected the art of literally printing digital money, fake money. They manufacture money or what appears to be money, and they then begin to launder it in banks around the world. And then they transfer it from bank to bank to bank where it gets washed. And then when the word goes out to thousands of people all over the world who get paid a couple hundred bucks to do this, they go to an ATM and they withdraw cash. So somewhere along the way, the fake manufactured money gets converted into cash. They take it out and then they launder hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Sometimes it's 10 million, sometimes it's 20 million. There was a case, he said, last year, $200 million. So we're talking in excess of billions of dollars of manufactured fake cash that's getting washed through the international banking community, withdrawn foreign by foreign people around the world through ATMs. The things that make our life in the digital economy easy have been used to rip off banks to the tune of, you know, billions of dollars. So why haven't we heard anything about this? And he said that he doesn't know why. He doesn't know why nobody's picked up on it, but that this is where he sees the greatest growth of fraud is in bank-to-bank transfers. So the thing that we were discussing that this is most similar to is the old fraud thing that Clark Howard and I have talked about for almost decades, right, where you get a call, you're selling a car, and somebody gives you a check for more than the car value, so then you, the cashier's check, and because it's a cashier's check, you and the bank assume that it's good, right? And you may even call the bank. The bank may even call the other bank to just double check these days to see if there's money in the account before cashing it. And you then are supposed to send the extra, if it's $10,000 and the car's $6,000, you're supposed to send the guy $4,000 back because he didn't, after the whatever shipping expenses that there are. And, you send him the missing money and blah, blah, blah. And what turns out is that the check is fraudulent. And you've now, on top of the $10,000 fraudulent check, you've now sent $2,800 of whatever was left over to the other guy. And that guy has disappeared and never existed anyway. And so you're on the hook for like $12,500. Or maybe you're just on the hook for the $2,500 plus the bank fees. That's the sort of real world physical equivalent of what this guy is saying is happening around the world. So Bank A in, I'm going to make this up, India or Russia or pick your place, gets a deposit of, X millions of dollars, and it looks like it's coming from, Bank B, and Bank B then, transfers it to this bank in Russia, let's say, and then Russia transfers it to a bank in India and transfers it to a bank in London, which transfers it to a bank in the Netherlands, which transfers it to a bank in Brazil, right? Everybody taking their fees out along the way, and then the last bank is the one that gets hit, and it changes all the time. And so all the other banks have gotten money in the fees, and the last bank gets left holding the bag. And the insurance company for the bank is really left holding the bag. So they're working on trying to capture these guys. It's usually guys. I don't know. Maybe it's women. These fraudsters. They're trying to nail them down. But there's a whole bunch of them springing up. And what this guy from the credit reporting bureau said is, look, the problem is they're much smarter than we are, and they're always a step ahead. That's the nature of crime, is to be a step or two or three ahead. And when you're a step or two or three ahead, it makes it really hard for everybody else to catch up. I mean, think about check kiting and that movie that Tom Hanks starred in, Catch Me If You Can, that really was the life of Frank Abagnale. And Frank Abagnale, as you may remember from the movie, was this young guy who just basically was able to sweet talk his way, this is pre-internet, and developed a very sophisticated method of check kiting and was writing fake checks all around the country and hopping onto planes and pretending to be a doctor with Harvard degrees, and he would manufacture everything. He'd fake it all out. And so that, his ability to stay one step ahead of Tom Hanks up until the end when he got nailed and was in a jail in, I think, France, and Tom Hanks brought him back, until that happened, right, he was able to pass off checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars and lead this incredible life. And then he actually became a bank check fraud expert, since he really was, and he went to work for the FBI, and now he's paid millions of dollars legitimately to work for banks and helping them create kiting-proof checks, basically. So it's really interesting, but he was always one step ahead or two steps ahead, and that's why the movie is called Catch Me If You Can, right? He was always taunting Tom Hanks. So these fraudsters aren't really doing the taunting. They don't really care what the FBI or the CIA or anybody else is thinking, and they don't really care what businesses are thinking. But the danger to our digital economy is serious. It's serious in my mind and in this guy's mind that I was talking to, because so much of what we do around the world depends on trust, and in a B2B world particularly. Can you imagine if you went and you borrowed money, and then that bank is trusting another bank to provide the money, and you have a multinational company and you're moving money around the world? What if you can't do that because the banks don't trust each other that the transfers are real? How do you prove that your $1 million that you're transferring to pay for something abroad is real? How do you do that? And there's a level of trust that's required around the world for the digital economy to happen. And if there's no trust, it's really hard to see how the digital economy is going to work. And so when you have these losses that are adding up into the tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, it's very, very difficult to imagine, or I should say, it's not very difficult to imagine that banks will get to a place where they're just like, I'm done. We're only doing stuff that we can verify in our own country, which would be fine if you're in Europe or fine if you're in the U.S., but not so great if you're trying to transfer money from India to Russia to Latin America back to the U.S. because you're Apple or you're McDonald's or you're whoever and your business is multinational. And then it does affect us all here. So if you remember back in 2007 and 2008, right, that seems like 100 million years ago, but it wasn't. If you remember back, one of the great things that was lost in the Great Recession was a level of international banking trust. And some of that had to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac selling loans, subprime loans, as grade A loans, right? And some of it had to do with some other investments that were made that were never not quite up to snuff. And so how is it that people can trust? How do banks and companies trust? How do we provide at least a modicum of trust, which we can all insure against, so that we're able to work in this world and have the world work for us. Now, another area that we talked about a lot on this plane trip was why the U.S. has never adopted chip technology and everybody else in the world basically had in order to protect our credit card data information. How do we make it much more difficult? And what this guy said, which was really interesting to me, is that the fraudsters were, again, one or two steps ahead. And what they were able to do that nobody has been able to do before that's very, very scary is they were able to crack what's known as point of purchase. So there's a lot of data encryption in the system passing the information inside a company, right, inside a Target. But when you go to Target and you put your credit card into that little slot that they have, that's for the point of purchase. That's when you're actually purchasing the goods. And putting it in and taking it out, that point of purchase is what the fraudsters were able to crack with the technology. They basically introduced some sort of software program. This is beyond my even comprehension how somebody could even imagine to do this, which is why I am not in the crime business. But they put it in and they were able to crack it and grab it right there where it's not encrypted. So, of course, now everybody's rushing to encrypt it. But if it was chip technology, the thinking is it would have been encrypted and it would have been protected. And so now you've got everybody working hard on that and getting chip technology accepted all over the country the way it is all over abroad, because it's just much safer. To go back to what this guy tweeted to me at Glink, at GLINK, he had a random $18 charge. Well, that's what's showing up. Random $9.54 charges or random $18 charges. You have to look and protect yourself. You have to look and see what's on your credit card. Check your statements all the time. Set up alerts. They're free. Have the alerts sent to you anytime there's a charge where the card isn't present. Anytime there's a charge over a certain dollar amount, you have to look and see. You own these cards. You have to take responsibility. Even if you're not ultimately responsible for the charges, you just want to know what's going on. Right? 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Lines are open, folks. Call now. On the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. I can hardly express. 54 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750 is our number, 1-800-WSB-TALK, and online at thinkglink.com. Check out the thinklinkstore.com for all kinds of cool stuff that we have and use the WSB discount code WSB for 25% off. Heather joins me on the line. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Hi, good morning, Elise.
Morning.
I have a dilemma. It is killing me, and I'm so glad I can talk to you. So my question is, well, first of all, briefly, background, I got tired of a commute. So I rented my personal home, which is 100% paid for,
mm-hmm.
and I am renting a condo. I'm not making any money on my home, and in fact, it's like an even exchange. And I've had to put money into my home, so now I don't know what to do because, again, this is personal and professional. I am kind of locked in for about 4 more years, and I don't know what to do. I don't want to go back to commuting all the time and staying on the road, but I don't like not having any money either. So I need your help. What should I do? Do I sell my house and buy something closer to the contract job?
Yeah, I would think so. Let's talk about what you've gotten out of this, because I can understand that financially it's not been a win for you, but it shouldn't really be a loss for you. If the home is paid for and you've got, you've got money coming in to cover all the costs, so
yeah.
that's a wash. It's just income property just now sitting there. It's not making a lot of money for you, but it's just sitting there. Now you're renting a condo, so you should be paying less for the condo that you were paying for the house, right?
I'm not. I am in, I think that I just kind of got myself into a position where it's a high demand for type of supply and demand. I'm paying a little more than I should.
You're paying more than you should. Okay, so when is your lease up?
It is actually up in the end of the summer, like around August, September, first of September.
Okay, and are there other condos that are less expensive that you can move into?
There are, and they are for sale.
Okay, and how much are they?
I'm sorry, Elise, can you hear me?
I said, how much are the condos that are for sale?
Well, they're some of them are in foreclosure for around 80.
Okay. So you'll have to buy those. It'll be hard to get a loan on
yes.
property like that, but you can probably get a loan on your personal residence. But it's a rental
and
property
that,
now.
That is correct. And I was told that I would not be able to take out, like, an equity loan on that because I'm not living in there at
right.
the time.
That is correct. So what you may want to do is you want to see if you can actually buy a foreclosure for around $80,000, and whatever you have cash to put down on it, I'm pretty sure you'll be spending less to live in this foreclosure than you're renting.
Oh, correct. Yes.
So let's see. Start by seeing if you can get qualified to buy one of these with, 10 or 20% down, if you've got that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, no, I think that's a great idea. I just didn't know if I should hang on to my personal home, or people are saying just put it on the market, but I don't think it's a good time.
Well, it's a great time depending on where it is, right? So property prices have gone up, and mortgage interest rates have stayed pretty low. So you've got a home that's 100% paid for. You've got a lot of purchasing power, as it says, right? You can price it at a place where it will sell, and then you can take all that cash and buy the condo and be close. That's an easy trade, right? The next thing that you
right.
can do is just go see if you can get qualified to buy the property, keep the house as is, and a little, next year you'll charge a little bit more for rent, and you'll buy the foreclosure for around $80,000, and you're going to cut your commute will be low, and you're going to cut your other costs, so you're going to be ahead, and now you've got two properties that you own. So I think that you actually have quite a lot of power here. You just need more information, which is where I always go when I don't know what to do. I try to get better informed. So start by talking to some lenders about what your options are. And I think the answer of what to do is going to become clear to you. My sense is you're going to end up buying the foreclosure and moving there, and all things are going to be rosy about 6 months from now. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
It's 12:30. 1207 on the Elise Blank Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinklink.com, thinklink.com. Sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It comes out Mondays and Thursdays. We've got Glinkonomics on Thursdays because that's the day when all the really cool numbers come out, folks. We've got all kinds of stuff on unemployment coming out this week. There's just, you know, it's all the numbers. All the numbers come out on Thursday. I don't know why. They just do. So Glinkonomics comes out on Thursdays. All of that, thinklink.com, free weekly newsletters, great information. Take advantage of it. Go to thinklink.com. And if you want to buy something, go to thinklink.com store or thinklinkstore.com. One of the two. Twitter, online, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So why did I buy a new car? Because of the snow. So those of you who are longtime listeners probably remember, oh, in 2003, when Sam and I bought our last new car. Well, actually, that's not really true. We bought another new car in 2006. 2005. So it's going to be 8 years old. But our van, our Honda minivan Odyssey, was bought in 2003. And here we were in... excuse me. All the stuff at the bottom of my throat from the dryness in the air. So... in the we're driving around all the snow in Chicago, and Sam just said to me, you know, I think it's time we looked at a new car. So we started to think about what we might want to do, because I have this rule where I really don't like to buy. I like to keep my cars at least 10 years. We hardly put any miles on them. This one, after 11 and a half years, only had, I don't know, 100,000 miles on it, maybe 102,000 miles. So I'd gotten past the 100,000-mile mark, which is the first time I've ever done that with any of our cars, even the ones that we kept for 12 or 13 years. But in the snow, so our car hadn't been washed in a really long time, and there's just so much salt. And I started the show by saying that basically every other day we're getting a snowstorm in Chicago. In fact, it's sunny today, but Tuesday we're due for another one. Very happy that I'll be around Atlanta most of the week and then going to California. So, anyway, I go and have the car washed, and I discover underneath the layers of salt and snow that there is a 15-inch crack, 8 in one direction, and then kind of turned down in a sort of, you know, 90-degree angle, and there's this huge crack in the windshield that I couldn't see, and you can't get your car washed when it's minus 9 with a minus 40 below windshield. You just can't. It'll end up freezing off. So we finally had a day that was in the 20s. Oh, this is, you know, like 3 weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago. And so I went and took the car for a wash because I definitely wanted to see what was going on. And sure enough, there was this big crack in the windshield. And I was completely wigged out by it because who knows when it had happened, but with all the salt trucks and you're driving on a highway, and now you guys, you know this, right? Because this week, there you were, trying to drive on a highway, and there's all this junk, right, that's getting kicked up, whether it's stones or, you know, anything else. And ice falling off a truck that's passing you going 65, 70 miles an hour hits your windshield, it could just crack it. And so I said to Sam, I've just had it, right? We're going to go. We got to go get this car replaced. And he said, well, why don't I first see if I can just get that fixed? And I said, it's pretty big. So he calls our insurance, which covers cracks, and if they can fix it, if they're small, they can usually just fix it. They don't have to repair the whole windscreen. So, of course, this was too big, and they're like, you have to repair it. So Sam went and test drove the 2014 Honda Odyssey, and it comes, wow, what a change in all these cars in 11 years. Maybe it's just my eyes now that I'm so old, but boy, we both test drove this car, and we were like, oh, there's navigation assistance now, and there's, you know, five cameras in the car that help you back up and show you how far away you are, and parking, and this and that. And the Honda Odyssey's had like 2.5 complete redesigns since 2003 when we bought ours. So then it was like, well, let's see about price. What's going on with price? We really liked it. And I travel all over the country, as you know, because I'm constantly telling you about things I'm discovering all over the country or all over the world as I come back. But, and so I rent a lot of cars, and I drive a lot of new cars. I'm so unimpressed, generally speaking, with new cars. I've tried them all. I mean, I don't do high-end cars because I don't really care about high-end cars, but I definitely go and I try, you know, the latest from Chevy and the latest from Mazda and the latest from Nissan and the latest from Ford and, you know, whatever. And, but this car was a great car. So I'm driving around this car and I'm thinking to myself, I really want to buy this car. But I know that they're, you know, they've got all these different levels. And the high-end touring Honda Odyssey is like, you know, some of the list prices like in the mid-40s or maybe even close to 50 now, which was sort of shocking. And I think we paid $27,000 for our last minivan. So Sam starts looking online, and what we discover was so interesting. So normally, and I talked about this at the end of the year, the best time to buy a new car is at the end of the year, generally speaking, because everybody's trying to make all their numbers for the end of the year. So you have all those big end-of-year sales. And truly, we've bought, you know, at least one of our new cars over the past 25 years at that time. So we were thinking about it. But, you know, suddenly it was the new year. We were away on vacation. We came back, and we didn't buy it. But what's happened is that several of the big car manufacturers are having horrible Januaries. So Honda is down 11% in sales, and I think that there are a couple of other big car manufacturers also down, and so the deals have been unbelievable. So Sam went online, and the internet pricing for the version of the Honda Odyssey that we were looking at, the list price was like $38,000. We were not buying the high end. We don't need all the, you know. Our kids are old. They don't need to watch, you know, TV in the back, each of them with their own, whatever they have. And we don't need an interior car vacuum. And, I mean, we're just going to, you know, we don't need all that high-end stuff. But I like having heated seats. I just like that. Anyway, so we were looking at the level of Honda, like the XL, and it was list price at $38,000, which I thought was really high, given that we paid $27,000 for the last one 11 years ago. I guess it's not that high, but it seemed high. Anyway, Sam was looking online, and the internet pricing was really low. And at our dealer of choice, right, the one right by the house, we got exactly the configuration we wanted for $32,000. $32,000. When I tell you it's like the fanciest car I've ever driven, it is. It feels very upgraded to me, right, because I've been driving an 11-year-old Odyssey. But it was so interesting. We started talking to the dealer, and he's like, well, I can go even lower if you take financing. They were offering like 0.9% or 0.9% financing. We don't need financing. So we said no. But you could have had an even a $500 off after that if we wanted to go through the financing. And he was telling us about how the sales are down, and Honda and a bunch of these other big companies are putting a lot of money towards getting these cars moved so people start driving them and seeing how great they are and hoping that people will, you know, think, go out and buy another car, which is never why anybody buys another. Maybe some people do. I don't buy cars based on that. You know, we bought it based on the fact that we're driving an 11-year-old car, and this is a horrible winter in Chicago. So when I'm in Chicago, it's just become, it just didn't feel that safe anymore. I mean, the car was driving fine. We've kept it maintained perfectly. They were thrilled to have it back. But it just felt like we needed more assistance with navigation with all the snow. Like I said, maybe it's just my age. But anyway, the point was that online, the internet pricing has gotten so good that we went in, we knew exactly what car, what the VIN number was, what the pricing was, and we ended up paying about $32,000 for the car, which, given how much more stuff is packed in this car, it's only $5,000 more than what we paid 11 years ago for our car. And I just thought that that was unbelievable. Anyway, that's how the snowiest winter in 30 years has forced me to finally give in and buy a new car. 404-872-0750. I don't know what you guys are driving these days, but I hope it's a good one. Let's go to the phones. John joins me on the line from Kennesaw. Hi, John.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. What's going on with you?
Hey, you know, it kind of has to do with cars. My newest car is actually 8 years old and got a bunch of miles on it. I'm at a point now where I've paid off my house and I have no debts and I pay my credit cards every month. But I'm having I'm having kind of a reverse reaction with my credit score. It's actually starting to go down, and although I'm not really looking to borrow money, is there a point where your credit score actually gets you in trouble? Because I could pay cash for a new car right now, or I could finance it and then, I guess, build up more credit history? I was trying to get an opinion on that.
So I got asked this question three times in the last week. Other people are having exactly the same situation. The guy I was with down in the South this week said that, you know, he's a big follower of Dave Ramsey's program, so he doesn't even have a credit card. And I said, that's really your problem. So the way that credit scores are optimized now, they're looking for a minimum of four active trade lines. So if you have a car loan, that would be one. A house loan would be two. And just active credit cards, you don't actually have to carry a balance, three and four. Or if you had a school loan that you were paying on, they're sort of optimized that way. Now, if you've had credit cards for a really long time and you just don't use them, that counts. But people who are now fully down the path and have paid off their house loan and don't carry a lot of different credit cards and all the rest, right, they follow along with the Dave Ramsey path, for example, you are noticing that the credit scores are going down. So this guy used to have an 800, now he's got a 750.
That's exactly the way I am. I was at 815, I'm down to 755 or something.
Right. So I would. And how many credit cards do you have?
I have two. I always use one, and I pay it off every month.
I would go add a couple of more credit cards on. It won't, since you pay them off, it doesn't really matter. Rotate one charge a month on them, a couple of charges a month. Pay them all off at the end of the month, and I think you'll start to see your credit score rise again. I don't think anybody has to take on debt to make your credit scores go up. As you know, I'm the managing editor of the Equifax Finance blog, and I talk to Equifax all the time. I talk to Experian and TransUnion, and it's not optimized for carrying debt. It's just optimized for active trade lines. So carrying a couple of more cards, whether or not you use them, I mean, I know, you know, carrying balances you don't have to do, but use them enough so that they stay in active rotation and they're showing you charging even 30, 50, 100 bucks a month, a couple hundred bucks, paying it off at the end of the month, just share around those charges. I think you'll start to see your credit score rise again. It just has to do with having four active trade lines. And 750 is fine, but as I said to this guy in the South the other day, who asked me exactly the same question, I said, I'd really like to see you at 780 or above. Even if you don't need credit today, you may at some point in time want to buy a house, refinance, some sort of big purchase, not even a car, just a bigger purchase, and you want to make sure that you're at a place at a moment's notice where you get the best possible price, best possible interest rate, and all the rest without having to do much at all. 404-872-0750. We've got the WSB McDonald's Weekend Prize Pack coming up next on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com at midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Minutes past the hour. News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Kling. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I want to talk a little bit about mortgage interest rates and how they fell again this week and some amazing deals people are getting. But first, I want to do the WSB McDonald's Weekend Prize Pack giveaway. Great tickets this week. It includes a pair of passes to the advanced screening of The Monuments Men on February 5th at the Regal Atlantic Station, and a pair of tickets to the Atlanta Ballet's production of Romeo and Juliet on February 7th. Nice Valentine's Day treat at the Cobb Energy Center. We are going to give it away to the fifth caller, like we always do, at 404-741-0750, which is our prize pack line. Don't call the regular line. Call 404-741-0750. We're going to give it to the fifth caller. Remember, you can only win once every 30 days. So whoever it was who won last week, you can't win again. But everybody else, open. The line is open. Be nice to Crystal because she's going to take your call. And good luck. 26 minutes past the hour. So something funny happened on the way to the fact that the Fed is now, well, goodbye Ben Bernanke. So congratulations and thank you for your service. And hello, Janet Yellen. And in the meantime, we have mortgage interest rates that fell this week, and not to mention the stock market, which was down 3% in January, and that this whole thing is just going exactly in the opposite direction of what everybody thought with the stock market and the way the economy's going, with this international freak out about or what's going on and possibly turning it around. And we had lower than expected home starts and home sales, and new home sales, and people are very unsure again about the economy. So the stock market dropped, you know, 3%. And Barron's this week talked about how what happens in January is the foreboding for the, you know, rest of the year. And so 88.5% of the time, if you're down in January, you're going to have a down stock market for the year. If you're up in January, you're going to have an up stock market. So, of course, there are times when that's not going to be the case, but, you know, 88.5% of the time it is. And it's so completely opposite from where we ended last year, up on an upswing, and everybody's like, oh, well, if you're up in December X percent, you're going to have a great following year. But the truth is we are well overdue for a major correction, and instability abroad is going to trump stock market platitudes every time. So one of the things that's really interesting is that this, of course, has the opposite effect. So we're seeing, instead of the stock market zooming and bonds rising, we're seeing the reverse. And so people who have bonds have been doing better, and people who have stocks are doing a lot worse, right? And so what we're seeing in conjunction with that is that mortgage interest rates have gone down. So I thought what we would do, coming back, is talk a little bit about mortgage interest rates and go over my four points, right? My four things that you need to know for a home run refinance. Because believe it or not, there are people out there who still have 6.5%, 7.5%, 8.5%, 10.5% loans. And I want you guys to wake up and get your heads out of the sand and refinance while the going is good. And it is really good right now. We're back to almost at 4% for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
On the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, thinkglink.com, at Glink on Twitter, at GLINK. Hey, and there's a Facebook page and all this other stuff as well, and thinklinkstore.com for the Intentional Investor Series. All right, 36 minutes past the hour, Wesley joins me on the line. Hi, Wesley.
How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. What's going on in your world today?
Well, I was in the purchase of a house, and I'm having problems because my credit score went down as well.
Really? What has your credit score gone down to?
It went down to like 735, 740, something like that.
And what was it the last time you checked?
It was like 775, something like that.
So that's interesting. So what's changed in your credit profile?
Well, they said that the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the changes that the government made when it came to income debt ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, you know, was it just that? Because I have everything else that you had mentioned earlier in the show. I have all those things in place.
So that's really interesting. Your debt to income ratio is usually a number that is looked at when you go to apply for a mortgage. Have you applied for a mortgage recently?
Correct.
You did. Okay. And so tell me a little bit about what debt you're carrying. And yes, Fannie and Freddie and FHA have all reduced, well, FHA not so much, but Fannie and Freddie have reduced the debt-to-income ratios that they're allowing. But it's still fairly generous. It's still over 40%. I think it's like 43%. But tell me what you've got going on in terms of debt.
Well, I didn't have much. I think I had like maybe a $500 note on a mortgage. I was just trying to purchase another home for my father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something more livable for him because he's, you know, he's in his 80s.
Okay.
So I was trying to get something that more like a ranch style, something that he can get in and out, that he won't fall and hurt himself.
So what happened? You went to go apply for this, which would be seen as a second home for you because it's for your father.
Right.
And you would own it.
Into the loan. Right.
Right. So that probably pushed you above the limit because you're not going to be getting income from your dad.
Correct.
If you could show that he was going to give, whether or not he does this, but if you could show that he was going to give you income against the cost of it, that ratio would probably change. And you could go to the lender and say, well, my dad's going to be contributing. And then they'd probably want to put him on the loan as well, which you may or may not want. But what did that do to the interest rate that you were offered for the mortgage?
Well, I was a little disappointed and upset about everything. I didn't even go as far as even asking for an interest rate. And I figured that it would affect me because I had dropped 30 or 40 points.
Right. So it would affect you some, maybe not as much as you think.
Okay.
Right? And so it's always worth, you didn't get rejected, right?
No, I didn't.
So
I didn't get rejected. It was just that I couldn't buy as much home. I didn't have as many options as I wanted.
Okay.
Desired.
Okay. So a couple of opportunities here. One is that you can go and get a copy of your credit history. Have you done that recently, looked at the credit history?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
It looks good.
It looks good. Great. Oftentimes when you get your credit history and you buy a copy of your credit score for $9, they tell you through annualcreditreport.com, it will tell you what else you can do to raise your credit score.
Okay.
And those, while sometimes that information is a little opaque, it depends where you buy it from, that generally will point into a few directions on how you can sort of raise it from time to time, right? Because... But if it's really a debt-to-income ratio, the other opportunity is to put your dad on the loan and buy the property as joint tenants with rights of survivorship so that you get it all when he dies.
Okay.
Which, frankly, is not a bad way to do it because even though it's a second home for you and not an investment property, you'll end up with it anyway. You're going to be making all of the payments. But on the mortgage, it'll look less, and that will get shared. And so he'll take a portion of the risk according to the way the lenders calculate it. And that should help out a little bit. So the opportunity is to say, okay, so let's think creatively about how we can get this done. What happens if, you know, we put him on the loan? You know, will that change what interest rate we're able to get, assuming that he's got great credit? I don't know what his credit history and score look like. I'm assuming they're perfect. And then talk to a number of different lenders about what kinds of programs they have for you.
Okay.
And how you can bring that down. Because if all you have is a mortgage that you're paying,
it's
unclear to me why a debt-to-income ratio would have even been raised, except that this new note against your income may push you past the 43% or 40% or whatever it is right now that they're calling for. But with your dad on, with his Social Security income added in or pension income or whatever it is, that should eliminate that issue.
Okay. Now, I want to keep on the line, but I have one more question. What was that you mentioned earlier that I need to do so that if he gets sick or if he passes, that I won't have a problem with the property?
Great. So it's called holding title. It's the way you hold the property title, so how the ownership is done.
Okay.
And you can hold it as joint tenants with rights of survivorship.
Okay.
So what that means is that you and he together own the whole property. So when he dies, you automatically inherit. You don't have to go through probate or anything else.
Okay, do I inherit any debt that might occur if he's hospitalized at the time?
You shouldn't.
And they couldn't come after the property?
Not be able to come after the property. Now, there are some other ways to protect against that as well, which is to put the property in a trust.
Okay.
And then it should be protected that way. So there's a bunch of different things that you can do. But buying it this way should help.
Okay.
Right? So I think that, you know, you should never get mad when you hear news that you're not expecting with a lender. And there's a couple of other things to say about that. I want to make sure you hear me really clearly, Wesley, because I don't think this is your fault. When you hear news that you don't like that interest rate is higher than what I've said it should be on the radio, or you've heard in ads, or you're getting pushback, it could be that the lender just doesn't want your business. And when I say that, it's not about religion or sex or color or race or anything like that. I sometimes lenders have had enough mortgage interest on second homes, and they don't want to keep it in their portfolio. In fact, I was on the phone with somebody from very high-level Bank of America and Chase and Wells Fargo, because I'm putting together a panel for my Society of American Business Editors and Writers Conference later in March, which, of course, I'll be reporting on here on the radio. And they were talking about how they're solving some of these problems by not reselling the mortgage debt. They're just keeping it in their house in portfolio debt. But what that means is that they've got very strict guidelines about how much of any one kind of loan, whether it's primary, rental, second mortgage, vacation, whatever it is, condo, co-op, that they're going to take. And so it's a certain amount per month, and sometimes if you're the person who comes after that, they don't want that, any more of that right now, and so they give you a higher interest rate, or they tell you that it's, you know, not going to be as good for you, because they want you to go away but be happy when you go away. So they're trying to find a way to make you go away happy, which never happens. You just got mad. But you should never get mad. You should always say, well, is there another way to slice and dice this? And what are we really talking about with interest rates? And then you should always compare at least four different lenders and different types of lenders, because they all may have a different take on it. So a local lender, a regional lender, a big national lender like, you know, Chase, Wells Fargo, Citi, or Bank of America, an internet lender, a mortgage broker, like those are five or six different types of lenders. And even though the federal government is still backstopping like 90% of all mortgages that are being made, each lender has its own prescription, and they price it differently, and they look at things differently, and they may even have different scores, credit scores. So one lender, you're a 735 to 740, and with another lender, you're 780.
Right. Okay.
So don't ever get mad. Just try to think outside the box and ask different questions. Well, what can I do to change this? Or what options do you have for me if this is my credit score? And how does it look if we add my dad on to this? Here's his, you know, his credit score, and everything is perfect with his money, and he gets this much a month. How does that change the picture? And try to make the system work better for you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Will you let me know what happens?
Yes, ma'am, I will.
All right. Have a good Sunday and enjoy the Super Bowl. 46 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. So I promised you the four rules for a home run refinance, and I think it's perfectly appropriate now because mortgage interest rates are bouncing all over. So earlier this week, mortgage interest rates were down to about 4.1%, and that's amazing. But we're also seeing that the growth, the GDP growth for the fourth quarter came in at a very solid 3.2%. So then it pushed up again and then went down again. If you get somewhere between 4 and 4.25 for a 30-year fixed rate loan, depending on how many points, fees, and whatever you're paying, you're doing great. All of the lenders are starting to implement the new QM, right, qualified mortgage, which Wesley was just talking about. And it is going to change the picture while they figure out, and it does take just a lot of loans going through the system to figure out what's going to work with these new QM rules. And the industry says it's going to cost more. I don't know if that's true. They tell you, oh, well, your interest rate is lower because of debt to income. You know, your credit score is lower because of debt to income ratio. But really, credit scores have nothing to do with debt to income ratio. So that could be confusing, and you may mishear that if you're out there. So how do you make it work for you? Number one, if you've got an interest rate above 5.5%, you should be thinking about refinancing. And I say that the new HARP.gov rules at HARP.gov is a new website that you can go to, HARP.gov, to see what's going on. They're still trying to push through some refis for people who are underwater or have less than 20% down. But if you have more than 20% down, your mortgage interest rate is at 5.5% or higher, and you have a decent credit score, you should go to refinance. Number one, try to lower the mortgage interest rate. Number two, lower your monthly payments, right? Number three, shorten the loan term. If you can do one thing, try to shorten the loan term. Go from, if you've got 25 years left, try to get a 20-year loan. If you've got 20 years left, go down to a 15-year loan. If you've got 15 years left, go to a 10-year loan. That's where you're going to save the biggest amount of money. And number four, manage your closing costs, right? So lowering the interest rate, lowering the payment, shortening your loan term, managing your closing costs. If you can do all four, home run refinance. Woo! But even if you could only do three of those, it's probably still worthwhile. Two of those, it may still be worthwhile, depends on which two. And if you only get to do one, shorten the loan term. 404-872-0750 on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 55 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750. Norman joins me on the line from Conyers. Hi, Norman.
Hi.
Hey, what's going on this Super Bowl Sunday for you?
I was calling. Well, too much of nothing, was waiting on the game.
But I understand
my
that.
The reason for calling is that my wife passed away about 6 months ago.
I'm sorry.
And that the house, the mortgage is in her name.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to the creditor, the mortgage company, and they told me that as long as I continue to pay the mortgage each month, that I can stay into the house. And then they told me also that I need to switch it over to my name and refinance again. But I told them, you know, that my credit is not right. Not yet. It takes about another year. I should have a credit. So about a year and a half to be up to standard.
Norman, did you inherit this house?
No. She didn't have a will.
Ah. And so she owned the house on her own?
Yes.
So important to have a will. And were you married? You were married at the time she died?
Yes.
Okay. And have you gone to court and probate?
No.
What are you doing about that?
Well, the only thing, me and my stepdaughter, she had my stepson. Oh, she only had two of her. We just decided to just go ahead and just sail into the house. I was looking for another house. I've been trying to find a house where I can pay cash for, you know, one of these foreclosures. But things hadn't been looking too good on that front.
What do you want to do with the house?
Well, I wanted to stay in the house. That's the main thing.
Okay. And so because there was no will, eventually the house will have to go through probate. And then the laws of Georgia will determine how the ownership of the house is parceled out. And the way it'll probably work is you will get half of the house because you are the spouse, and the children will, whatever her living children, will share the other half.
Uh-huh.
So if they're in the house or not, that's probably how it'll end up. And then you three will have to refinance the house, or you'll have to pay off the loan and do something else. And so the lender is right. You can just sort of stay in the house and pay the loan. I don't know if you have to do it within a year or more, but you really should just keep making all the payments and then try, once the court, like if the court determines that you've inherited the whole house and the kids get the other stuff, or you make a trade so that you get this piece of it and they get that piece of the accounts or whatever else was left, right? Then, because you inherit that property and you were married, you probably would be allowed to just keep the mortgage as is. So you have to go through probate and figure out how it's all going to work out. And you really are going to need to probably hire some sort of an estate attorney to help you with that process and to figure out. And it just goes to the very bottom point, which is, please, folks, if you do not have a will, make a will, a simple will. If you have assets like a house, if you have loved ones you're leaving behind, like children and a spouse, and you care about what happens to them, and you care about what it is they have to go through to get everything organized, please make a will. Put it into a trust. Let somebody know what your wishes are. When you die, you just want your loved ones to be able to focus on the loss and not in dealing with the money. Norman, I hope it works out for you. Folks, we've got to run. Happy Super Bowl Sunday. I'll be back next week with an awesome show. We have a New York Times bestselling columnist who will be on. Stay tuned for that, and find me online at thinklink.com. Have a great week.